BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm Donald MacLeod, and thanks for downloading this highlights version of Composer of the Week. There's information on all the music you'll hear, as well as our terms of use, on the Radio 3 website at bbc.co.uk/radio3. Some snap, said his brother. A century ago, in 1918, an energetic young accompanist and budding songwriter was offered $35 a week from a publishing company for any songs he might compose in the future. It would turn out to be a canny investment on behalf of Harms, America's biggest publisher of popular music. So who was this young piano player they were prepared to take a punt on? His name was George Gershwin, and the songs he would go on to compose came to define the American songbook. Perhaps none more so than this one. The piano is at the root of Gershwin's music. His mother, Rose, aspiring to upward mobility, decided the Gershwins needed a piano and that her eldest son, Ira, would learn to play it. But it was the hoisting up and in through the window of the family's Lower East Side apartment of a second-hand upright bought on the instalment plan, which literally opened a window on a new world for Ira's younger brother, George. From that starting point, here's the cellist Yo-Yo Ma giving us his take on Gershwin's Three Preludes. George thought of himself as a child of the Lower East Side, though he could also be described as a child of a number of other New York neighbourhoods. Like many immigrants, the Gershowitzes Americanized themselves into Gershwins. Theirs was a peripatetic existence, moving around various areas of New York City, aiming to up their stakes. In the 20 years from 1898, when George was born, there were 25 changes of address, mostly on Manhattan's Lower East Side, as the family moved from apartment to apartment, reflecting their fluctuating fortunes. As Ira recalled, we were always moving. Their father, Morris, a Russian immigrant, would like to have been an entrepreneur in the mould of so many who'd come to the United States and made their fortunes, but he lacked the necessary drive and acumen. He was a gentle, good-natured man, possibly even a little naive, who was forever starting up new business ventures, only to abandon them when he got bored. Although the family's fortunes fluctuated, in general, the Gershwins were fairly comfortably off. They had a maid, there was that symbol of middle-class respectability, the piano, and they had a record player too, and Rose had at least one fur coat. George and Ira would wander the streets of the Lower East Side, a mixture of dilapidated tenements and middle-class apartment blocks, teeming with horse-drawn wagons, pushcarts, and hordes of people, the air thick with the sounds of the horns of the newfangled automobiles, the din of riveting machines on building sites, hurdy-gurdy players, street cries, Yiddish street singers, military bands, and jazz bands. But the brothers would also venture up to Chinatown, Harlem, and the West Side, absorbing all kinds of influences. His Aunt Kate said of the young George, "He was a pretty wild boy. People used to say, 'Mrs. Gershwin has nice children, but that son of hers, she's going to have trouble with that son George.' George's exasperated father predicted he would grow up to be a bum. It may have been the piano that saved him from that fate. Certainly music did. George remembered two pivotal experiences from childhood, standing outside a penny arcade, mesmerised by the sound of an automatic piano leaping through Anton Rubinstein's Melody in F. And, as a 10-year-old, hearing a violin prodigy at his school playing Dvorak's Humoresque, a flashing revelation of beauty, he called it. And so, by the time the family did acquire that piano in 1910, young George amazed the family with his independently acquired expertise. Equally amazing is his piano concerto, only his second concert work, written at the age of 27. George packed in school altogether at the age of 14. A friend of his worked in Tin Pan Alley, the New York songwriting and publishing business centred on 28th Street between Broadway and 6th Avenue. He introduced George to Mose Gumbel, the manager of one of the most successful publishing firms, Jerome H. Remick & Co. And so George found himself, day after day, smartly dressed in a suit and sporting a natty bow tie, in a tiny, stuffy, smoke-filled room, one of a long line of cubicles, each with an upright piano. Like the young men in the other cubicles, he was paid to play for up to 10 hours a day, as performers came by the offices of the firm of music publishers looking for new songs for their acts. It was a song-plugging sweatshop. Pluggers, usually pianists or singers or both, had to be able to put over a song to the customers and needed to get on well with the entertainers who dropped by to hear the latest songs. So it was a very valuable training for Gershwin, who soon became a much sought-after accompanist. But he never forgot how some of the customers would treat him like dirt. There were others, though, such as the songwriter Irving Caesar, who dropped by Remick's just for the pleasure of hearing Gershwin play. Caesar remembered, "His rhythms had the impact of a sledgehammer. His harmonies were years ahead of the time. I had never before heard such playing of popular music." It's clear all the other pluggers were madly jealous of Gershwin's virtuosity. Word got around that he was a brilliant pianist and that he wrote his own songs, and it wasn't long before he was introduced to the most powerful publisher on Tin Pan Alley, Max Dreyfus of T.B. Harms. Dreyfus said Gershwin was the kind of man I like to gamble on. He was the man who signed him up for $35 a week just for the right of first refusal on all his songs. There was always a tension in Gershwin's work between the purely popular and the innovative. Pushing the envelope was the kind of thing he liked to do. In 1922, Gershwin wrote what he called an opera a la Afro-American, a sentimental tale set in a basement bar in Harlem, whose theme, we're told in the prologue, will be love, hate, passion, and jealousy. From that show, here's Barbara Hendricks with the song Young Vi Sings, looking for her boyfriend. Has anyone seen Joe?
It couldn't be that I have missed you.
first glimpse of a true opera composer. Has anyone seen Joe from the early one-act opera Blue Monday? One hostile critic, and there were many, wittily described Blue Monday as freeze-dried Pagliacci. And indeed, Gershwin borrowed a number of elements from that Verismo standard-bearer from 1892, including the prologue announcing a tale of love and jealousy, the story set against a background of popular entertainment, and a character who, rejected by the heroine, exacts a bloody revenge. Yet elements of the setting and the story also look forward 13 years to Porgy and Bess. One person who admired Blue Monday was the 32-year-old bandleader Paul Whiteman. Some 3 years later, he gave two performances of the work in a revised form as 135th Street. Nobody much liked it then either, but it didn't really matter, since by then Gershwin and Whiteman had created a sensation and put themselves firmly on the map with Gershwin's most famous concert work, Rhapsody in Blue, which Gershwin performed himself. Here's a recent brief variation.
Music move us? How does it do it? Well, if these are questions that have been firing you up, I've got the very podcast for you. I'm Tom Service from BBC Radio 3, and from Schubert symphonies to video game music, from how to start a piece of music and when to end it, from background music to birdsong, from Beethoven to Beyoncé, from Bach to the future, thank you very much indeed, the Listening Service podcast is your guide to how music works, and all kinds of music too, the mastery and mechanics behind the magic. Just search for the Listening Service on BBC Sounds and learn more about the music we all love.
The real American folk song is a rag, a mental jam, a rhythmic tonic for the chronic blues. The critics call it a joke song, but now they've changed the tune and they like it somehow.
It's inoculated with a syncopated sort of beat.
Sort of sweeter.
Sweeter than a classic street boy who can remain still and quiet.
Dum, 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 dum. For it's a riot, the real American folk song is like a fountain of youth. You taste and it elates you and then invigorates you. The real American folk song, a buzz stroke song, is a rag.
Don't be misled. The attribution of the words of The Real American Folk Song, music by George Gershwin, to one Arthur Francis is a smokescreen. George's modest elder brother, Ira, didn't want people thinking he was cashing in on his brother's burgeoning fame, so he came up with that pseudonym compounded of his other brother's name and a masculinization of his sister's. That song from 1918 marked the first collaboration of what would prove to be one of the great songwriting partnerships of all time. George and Ira Gershwin. Though The Real American Folk Song is a Rag was a hit when it reached Broadway, it wasn't published until more than four decades later, when it was popularised by the first ever recording of the song by Ella Fitzgerald. It's a very good illustration of just how perfectly attuned Ira the lyricist was to his brother's music. The ragtime of that song was an early form of jazz, and that's my theme for today, Gershwin and jazz. The critic Paul Rosenfeld wrote an essay on jazz which began, "American music is not jazz. Jazz is not music." He plainly had no idea what jazz was. For him, Gershwin's compositions are distinguished by their vicious, sometimes vivacious and adroit, at other times coarse and brutal exploitation of the jazz idiom, rhythms and colours. Gershwin is the composer of the jazz age. In an article he wrote, Gershwin called jazz the voice of the American soul. Having been born in New York, he wrote, and grown up among New Yorkers, I have heard the voice of that soul. It spoke to me on the streets, in school, at the theatre. In the chorus of city sounds, I heard it. In the mid-1920s, at the peak of the Harlem Renaissance, frequenting the extravagant integrated parties thrown by the novelist, photographer and music critic Carl van Vechten, Gershwin met such influential figures as Paul Robeson, Bessie Smith and the Johnson brothers, the composer John Rosamond Johnson and his polymath brother James Weldon. Gershwin was very fortunate in the artists who chose to perform his songs, both in his lifetime and after. Jazz means something slightly different in the 1920s. In his biography of the composer, Howard Pollack points out Gershwin's indebtedness to Irving Berlin and to one song in particular, Alexander's Ragtime Band. Gershwin greatly admired the song and held it up in contrast to both the ragtime songs of the 1890s and the concert music of the likes of Edward McDowell as the first real American musical work. Berlin had shown us the way. It was now easier to attain our goal. Irving Berlin had used the word ragtime for music which by 1917 was being referred to as jazz, and indeed in the 1920s, as we can see from Gershwin's discussion of the popular music of the time, Alexander's Ragtime Band was often taken as the starting point. Gershwin generally didn't like writing about music, but he was prevailed to do so a few times, penning pieces such as The Composer in the Machine Age and The Relation of Jazz to American Music, which appeared as part of a symposium edited by the composer Henry Cowell. As Howard Pollack points out, the views Gershwin expresses are often contradictory, and his use of the term jazz is somewhat vague. He often spoke of jazz as a kind of style, but avoided technical explanations. He observed that J.S. Bach also used syncopation. He dated the origins of jazz to the early 1910s and, as Pollack says, asserted that it emerged from what he called plantation songs and ragtime, improved and transformed into finer, bigger harmonies. Gershwin said, "Europeans cannot write jazz. It belongs peculiarly to America. It is American music and nothing else. Jazz," he said, "is the result of the energy stored up in America. It reflected American life, nervous, hurried, syncopated, ever accelerando, and slightly vulgar." In an article in 1926, Gershwin wrote, "It's true that many of the street songs of today are jazz in character, but our best jazz is far too good musically to be popular in the street." But he was also capable of writing of jazz as crude, vulgar, ugly, noisy, boisterous, full of animal vigour and unthinking vitality, even, Pollack points out, associated with evil. In the end, for Gershwin, it came down to one thing. Basically, it's a matter of rhythm. One of Gershwin's own songs came to play a pivotal role in the history of jazz, the last one we heard, I Got Rhythm. It was first heard, hammered out by Ethel Merman in the show Girl Crazy, and became one of the most recorded songs ever, the most played jazz classic of all time. One writer described it as nothing less than an embodiment of a new sensibility that places music, and specifically rhythm, and even more specifically jazz rhythm, at the centre of what matters in American life. Musicians and arrangers have delighted in elaborating variations on the song. It was a favourite with George Gershwin himself, who liked it so much he wrote a work for piano and orchestra called I Got Rhythm Variations. We'll be right back. During the 1920s, the associations of jazz brought it under constant attack. For many, it represented the pernicious, seedy side of life, crime, drug addiction, alcoholism, and prostitution. Jazz was beginning to sweep across America at the time when the Prohibition lobby was flexing its muscles. In the journal New York American, an article appeared in 1922 warning of the moral disaster that was coming to hundreds of young American girls through the pathological, nerve-irritating, sex-exciting music of jazz orchestras. The degrading music, the writer went on, is common not only to disorderly places, but often to high school affairs, to expensive hotels, and so-called society circles. When Duke Ellington set up his band at the Cotton Club in New York in 1927, all the staff and performers were black, while all the customers were white. In 1923, Gershwin accompanied the Canadian-born mezzo-soprano Eva Gautier in a group of American songs by Jerome Kern, Irving Berlin, and himself. Also in her programme, with a different pianist, were songs by Hindemith and Schoenberg. Gautier had appeared in the London premiere of Debussy's opera Pelléas and Mélisande. The band leader, Paul Whiteman, was in the audience for that recital. Whiteman earned opprobrium through his efforts to make jazz respectable, which is to say, white. It was in 1923 that Gershwin made his first trip to this country to write the music for a new review. Paul Whiteman was in London at the same time with his orchestra playing at the Hippodrome. The audience was there not to sing or dance to the music, but to listen. This greatly appealed to Whiteman, and he began to plan an event which would take American popular music, jazz, into the concert hall. Let's hear Blossom Dearie in Someone to Watch Over Me.
There's somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone to watch over me. I'm a little lamb who's lost in the wood. I know I could always be good to one who'd watch.
Paul Whiteman was quite a showman. He couldn't get into Carnegie Hall, which was booked up solid, but he decided to put on a concert in the only slightly less prestigious Aeolian Hall, which he grandly declared would sketch musically from the beginning of American history the development of our emotional resources which have led us to the characteristic American music of today. Gershwin was highly flattered when he was asked to take part, but although he and Whiteman had discussed the idea of writing a concerto-like piece, he was flabbergasted, playing pool one day at the Ambassador Billiard Parlour, to have Ira read out from that day's paper that he was already at work on a jazz concerto, which would appear alongside works by other luminaries like Irving Berlin and Victor Herbert. The concert was set for the 12th of February, Abraham Lincoln's birthday, only 5 weeks away. Gershwin rang Whiteman the next day to say he couldn't possibly do it. He didn't have a shape or an idea in his head. Whiteman was very persuasive. Plainly, Gershwin had no time to lose. His own accounts of how long he took over it vary between 10 days and 3 weeks, but either way, Rhapsody in Blue is an amazing piece of work. Gershwin gave Whiteman a two-piano sketch of the score, and it was Whiteman's regular arranger, Ferdy Griffey, who made the orchestration. Gershwin once said that he got the idea for the whole construction of the work from the steely rhythms he heard travelling on a train, but it's a piece which seems to capture the essence of the brave, brash spirit of New York. Look how many filmmakers have used it as an instant shorthand for the Manhattan skyline. But it also proclaims the coming of age of America's musical identity. That jazzy, sliding wail from the clarinet at the start apparently came about accidentally. The virtuoso player at one rehearsal turned the last half of what was originally a scale passage into that slide. Everyone was captivated, including Gershwin, who insisted he should play it that way on the night. After that famous opening comes music very much influenced by Jewish klezmer bands. Half past five on the afternoon of February the 12th, 1924, we took our fifth curtain call. Paul Whiteman recalling that epoch-making concert in which Rhapsody in Blue was first revealed to the world. He had almost lost his nerve just before this concert, which posed the question, what is American music? He'd invited Stravinsky and Rachmaninoff, among others, to give the answer. In fact, nobody did give an answer, but the one thing they all talked about was Gershwin's music, whether they loved it or hated it. How did something delicious turn into a rhapsody in rivets? George Gershwin went to Hollywood, lured by a massive fee of $70,000, to write the score for a film called Delicious, which included a New York rhapsody depicting, at one point, riveters at work on the city's skyscrapers. To his chagrin, much of Gershwin's music never made it into the finished film, released in 1931. But then Gershwin found himself greatly honoured, along with Hindemith, Honegger, Prokofiev, Ravel, Respighi, Roussel and Stravinsky, to be asked by the conductor, Serge Koussevitzky, to write a new work for the Boston Symphony on their 50th anniversary in 1931. At first, Gershwin turned Koussevitzky down, saying he was too busy working on an opera. But after working on the film, he realised he had a ready-made piece that could be put to use. His second rhapsody, a 14-minute work for solo piano and orchestra, was salvaged from the music originally called Rhapsody in Rivets. It's a far more symphonic piece than his earlier concert works, and Gershwin considered it the best he'd yet written. Full of youth and recklessness, it is America of untrammelled manners and cocktail energy. One critic's response to the first performance in New York of The Second Rhapsody by George Gershwin. The kind of juxtapositions Gershwin was capable of, particularly perhaps in the first rhapsody, the one in blue, revealed that he was someone who never really got why so many people, then and now, insist on putting popular and classical music in hermetic compartments. After the immense success of Rhapsody in Blue, Gershwin gave more time to concert music. He may have been the toast of the Great White Way, but his attempts to move musically out of the theatre district and into the hallowed portals of the city's concert halls were, despite some successes, constantly frustrated and a source of disappointment to him. He never found the approval he craved for his concert music. Some of the most entrenched resistance he encountered was at home in America, though Maurice Ravel could find it in himself to admire what Gershwin had done in fusing jazz with symphonic writing. Gershwin's desire for technical improvement led to his asking serious composers to give him lessons. Ravel's famous response when Gershwin approached him was, "Why be a second-rate Ravel when you are a first-rate Gershwin?" Ravel did give him a letter of recommendation for the great French teacher Nadia Boulanger, who declined to teach him for pretty much the same reasons. While on his quest in Paris, Gershwin apparently got the idea for an orchestral piece which featured the bustling sounds of Parisian life, complete with traffic noise and taxi horns. This was to be his orchestral ballet, as he thought of it, An American in Paris. He came back from France with a suitcase full of taxi horns and the complete works of Debussy in 8 volumes in his luggage. As usual, the audience went wild at the premiere, and, as usual, the critics gave it a mixed reception, ranging from nauseous claptrap to futile and inept. Gershwin's champion, the journalist Karl van Vechten, wrote to him, "The concert was a riot. You crowned it with what I am forced to regard as the foremost serious effort by any American composer. Go straight on, and you will knock all Europe silly." Gershwin had been working on An American in Paris while his next musical, Treasure Girl, opened on Broadway. Even with a Gershwin score that included some songs that would later prove to be winners, and with Gertrude Lawrence as the star, this show turned out to be bass metal rather than gold, folding after only 68 performances. Soon after that came a real-life drama that made all this Broadway stuff look very silly, the Wall Street crash. Bizarrely, the turnaround this brought in public attitudes changed the wind in Gershwin's favour. The show Strike Up the Band, which had also flopped a few years earlier, one of Gershwin's biggest turkeys, when it had been thought to be too intellectually demanding, too acerbic, too sharp, now came into its own. George S. Kaufman's book, with its barbed satirical edge and its anti-war, anti-profiteering stance, hadn't been at all to the taste of optimistic theatre-goers in 1927, quite happy with the usual musical comedy hokum. Strike Up the Band had been a step into a musical no-man's land, unlike anything the Gershwins had ever done before, with the songs completely welded into the dramatic texture so as to tell the story. The show was too far ahead of its time, perhaps, preempting 1950s musicals like Oklahoma. But the Depression changed all that, and a revised version of the show in 1930 was a hit. Gershwin, his confidence boosted by his successes in the concert hall, decided to conduct the pit orchestra on opening night. His early biographer, Isaac Goldberg, noted that the composer conducts with a baton, with his cigar, with his shoulders, with his hips, with his eyes, with whatnot, yet without any antics for the eyes of the audience. This is the overture to Strike Up the Band.
Thank you.
In his quest to make his music acceptable in the concert hall, Gershwin had lessons with a number of composers. Two of them are pretty much forgotten now. Wallingford Rieger was a prolific and versatile composer who wrote a symphony, a study in sonority for 10 violins, and film music. He was one of the first American composers to use a version of the 12-tone method. Gershwin studied harmony with Rieger. Gershwin evidently felt he was at a dead end of creative musical experience when he began what would be 3 years of working with Joseph Schillinger, who also gave lessons to Glenn Miller, Oscar Levant, Tommy Dorsey, Benny Goodman, and Jerry Mulligan. It's interesting that the three composers Gershwin sought out were not conventional. The third teacher was Henry Cowell, with whom he had intermittent lessons over about 2 years. Cowell's judgment on Gershwin was rather harsh. He wrote that Gershwin's attempts to fuse classical music and jazz had failed to create anything worthy in this idiom, because he makes the mistake of removing the jazzy elements when he arranges his jazz for classic works, and the residue is a sticky and commonplace sentimentality. Schillinger's influence may be detectable in the greater clarity of orchestration over previous scores of Gershwin's Cuban Overture. Gershwin had taken a holiday with a few friends in Havana. The amazing array of percussion instruments he heard and the infectious rhythms of the music fired his imagination, and he decided to put them into this new orchestral work. As he'd done with car horns in Paris, he went shopping and shipped back a crate load of Cuban instruments. As he put it himself, "I have endeavoured to combine the Cuban rhythms with my own thematic material, and the result is a symphonic overture which embodies the essence of Cuban dance." So, get ready to rumba. That was the title Gershwin originally gave it to the heady rhythms of his Cuban Overture. George Gershwin's Cuban Overture, which had its premiere not in a concert hall, but as part of what was the first all-Gershwin concert anywhere at the Lewison Stadium, a huge outdoor venue in New York, which has since been demolished. 5,000 people had to be turned away, and the lucky 18,000 who got in responded enthusiastically to the music. Violin of Jascha Heifetz, with the pianist Emmanuel Bay there, imitating the voice of the broken-hearted Serena, weeping over the body of her dead husband Robbins in that number, My Man's Gone Now, from George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Gershwin's stage work, premiered in October 1935, is regarded as the first great American opera. It was pioneering for its time in being set in a black American community and performed by black artists. Writing an opera had been an ambition of Gershwin's throughout his career, and specifically the idea of a black American opera had been burrowing away in his mind since the one-act Blue Monday Blues from 1922. 4 years later, he came across a recently published novel by DuBose Heyward, who'd grown up among the labourers and stevedores of Charleston, South Carolina. All that he'd absorbed about their lives was reflected in his story, Porgy, about a crippled beggar in the tightly knit black community there. Gershwin was instantly gripped by the idea that the story would make a great opera. He wrote off to Heyward at once to suggest they work on it together, and though the author was enthusiastic, he explained that he and his wife were already turning the book into a play. That was fine. Gershwin thought there was room for both play and opera, and he told Heyward that he wanted to spend several years studying before he started on the opera. Porgy and Bess is set in Catfish Row, a tenement in a poor fishing community in Heyward's Charleston. It charts the love affair between the crippled beggar, Porgy, and a young prostitute, Bess. Bess, You Is My Woman Now, from Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Gershwin was deeply committed to Porgy and wanted to get the atmosphere and the details exactly right. So, in the summer of 1934, he finally settled in for a long stay in Charleston, South Carolina, renting a ramshackle beach cottage on Folly Island, a barrier island off the coast. No running water, no telephone, and sand crabs everywhere. Gershwin shipped in an upright piano. He delighted in the back-to-nature pleasures of not shaving for days at a time and working in swimming trunks, though naturally not on his visits to local churches, where he joined in, enthusiastically, some of the more exuberant moments of congregational participation, as well as homes, nightclubs, prayer meetings, anything that would feed his inspiration. Gershwin was especially intrigued by the so-called Gullah Negroes who lived on nearby James Island, whose singing of spirituals involved vigorous, what they called, shouting. In fact, complicated rhythmic patterns they beat out with their hands and feet, which Heyward suggested was, indubitably, an African survival. And it was this that Gershwin joined in so enthusiastically. These experiences fed into some of the choral writing in the opera. Not everyone approved of what Gershwin created. There were those at the time who accused Gershwin of racism, who saw the whole enterprise as a patronizing portrayal, a white man's view of a black community full of stereotypes, of superstition, whoring and gambling, by someone who knew nothing about the black experience. This perspective tended to be the one of black people living in New York in the 1930s, a kind of life which was a world away from the very specifically located fishing community in the south of Catfish Row. Duke Ellington pointed out that though the cast were black, every member of the creative and production teams on Porgy and Bess was white.
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. Little David was small, but oh my. Little David was small, but oh my. He fought big Goliath, who laid down and died. Little David was small, but oh my.
The opening of the show in Boston in September 1935, 4 days after Gershwin's 37th birthday, was a triumph. There was a standing ovation. Then, the following month, the opera, now somewhat savagely truncated for Broadway, in Boston it had run for 3 hours, moved to the Alvin Theatre, now known as the Neil Simon Theatre, in New York. In the audience were Kirsten Flagstar, Joan Crawford, Fritz Kreisler and Katharine Hepburn. Here, the reception was a good deal cooler. The composer Virgil Thompson, disregarding the research Gershwin had done, wrote, "I do not like fake folklore, nor fidgety accompaniments, nor bittersweet harmony, nor six-part choruses, nor gefilte fish orchestration. At best, it is a highly unsavoury stirring up of Israel, Africa and the Gaelic Isles. Gershwin doesn't even know what an opera is." To be fair to Thompson, he added, "And yet, Porgy and Bess is an opera, and it has power and vigour." Porgy and Bess had a decent run of 124 performances, but when it closed, it had lost the then enormous sum of $70,000. A number of the opera songs have gone on to become standards. "Summertime," "It Ain't Necessarily So," "Bess, You Is My Woman Now," "I Got Plenty of Nothing," sources of inspiration to musicians of every kind. Here's the pianist Keith Jarrett, who played with Art Blakey and Miles Davis, having his way with "I Loves You, Porgy." Of the opera's production in New York, working in Hollywood for Samuel Goldwyn, or rather, as he told his sister Frances, for the money, Gershwin became lonely and depressed. He wrote to a friend, "I am 38, famous and rich, but profoundly unhappy." He had plans for the future, though. He said he'd need more than 100 years to get all the ideas he had down on paper. There was a string quartet buzzing around in his brain, using tunes he'd heard on Folly Island. "It's going through my head all the time," he wrote, "and as soon as I've finished scoring the next picture, I'm going to rent me a little cabin up in Coldwater Canyon, away from Hollywood, and get the damn thing on paper. It's about to drive me crazy. It's so damn full of ideas." There had been warning signs of what was to come. Classic signs, if only the right person had been there to read them. Some 3 years before he died, Gershwin began to complain, no matter where he was, that he could smell burning. But apart from that, there was nothing much until exactly 5 months before his death, when he'd been playing his own concerto with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. He made a mess of a simple passage in the first movement, and then there was another audible mistake in the following movement. He told his friend Oscar Levant that he thought he'd blacked out for a moment. And there again was that smell of burning rubber. There had been headaches, too. Eventually, Gershwin collapsed and was rushed to hospital in a coma, and after 5 hours of surgery to try to remove what was, all too late, discovered to be a deeply embedded tumour, Gershwin never recovered consciousness. Let's end with the seldom-heard Suite from Porgy and Bess, which Gershwin himself made, weaving together some of its most famous numbers. It was completely forgotten about until 1958, when it had to be renamed Catfish Row, since Robert Russell Bennett had meanwhile got in with a commercially very successful suite from the opera. Gershwin's own condensation of the opera has the advantage of including a good deal of the darker material, which naturally reflects a view of the score which presents a much stronger case for Gershwin as a serious composer. The third movement of the suite is a fugue.